So to start, I'd like to welcome Nicole Portnov. She's also a former research assistant with Carrie Bettinger. She's worked on the case, and this is an important part of her work going forward. And now I'd like to introduce Jessica Lanahan.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your willingness to tell this story and to share your story with all of us in the documentary. And I just want to say how sorry I am for your loss, not only just for your children and for everything that you've been through, but even your mom. I mean, your mom was such a wonderful support and lovely woman in the documentary. I fell in love with her too. So thank you, and so sorry for what you've been through. Can you talk about why you decided to share this story and how this documentary came about?
Yeah, absolutely. It seemed like this story was being requested over and over and over again for years, and for years I told the story. Eventually it got to a place where I was realizing it wasn't helping me any longer and that I needed to document and share, continue to share. And the best way to do that was through film. And the reason it needed to be done was because lives were being lost unnecessarily. Women are still being treated as second and third class citizens, and even less when our government actors don't respect us enough to protect us. So somebody needed to be that voice, because losing three children, I couldn't endure watching anybody else lose their children. And unfortunately, it seemed like my case set precedence for men to torture and murder their children and their wives. And my case set that example, which was frightening to me. So we needed to turn that around. And that's why I did it.
So when you think about when this all happened, what was it like for you, and who was there for you? Who did you rely on? Who helped you through this difficult time?
You know, I've been gifted with really wonderful attorneys, but my mother was my number one champion. And without her strength, I don't think I would have been able to follow her example. Ironically enough, she sued the federal government and won. And so I'm a second generation in doing that. It's not something to be proud of, as it is just factual and sad that it had to be that way. So I've had a lot of support and a lot of blessings in this time.
So have you had contact with anyone in Colorado, the police department, or what's happened to this case? What's happened in Castle Rock, Colorado? What's evolved in Colorado since this time?
It's really a sad case. It's still a very rogue state. It's wild, wild west, pretty much. They govern themselves. There's really no obligation for our officers to know their jobs or do their jobs. And there is no accountability when our children are lost the way mine were. So I still don't know what happened to my children. All of the evidence was destroyed about 3 weeks after their deaths, and I don't know anything surrounding my own children's deaths.
And what's the reason for that?
Colorado laws don't represent my allegations against them, and because there is no evidence left to tell me what happened to the children, they destroyed all that.
So, Nicole, can you maybe help shed some light on that? Because her case was against the police department at that time, or can you talk a little bit more about what happened?
Sure. So, and also, I want to thank everyone for the warm welcome and the invitation. I'm honored to be here, and you know, I don't think anyone can substitute for Carrie, but I'll do my best. Jessica's lawsuit was against the Colorado Police Department, as well as a handful of specific officers. At the district court level, the lawsuit against the specific police officers was essentially dismissed, right? The officers were determined to have had qualified immunity. And the Jessica's 1983 claim, it's a civil rights claim against the Colorado Police Department, was what went forward and was appealed, right, went through the appeals process to the Supreme Court.
Was it because the police violated her civil rights because they didn't pursue looking for her children on the night that this happened? What was the reasoning?
Yes, the rationale for the 1983 claim was that the police were shown a restraining order, and the restraining order contained language that was reflective of a Colorado state statute. That language directed the police to, in no uncertain terms, arrest someone who has violated the restraining order, right? So Jessica had this restraining order. She showed it to the police. The language on the restraining order and the statute, the Colorado law that supports the restraining order, makes arrests mandatory. And if you read through all of the sort of supporting documents that the Colorado legislature went through as they passed this law, the purpose of that statute and the language in the restraining order was to make arrests mandatory and to remove police discretion, right? That was the explicit intent of the statute when it was passed. Unfortunately, the Colorado Police Department decided that they still had this discretion, this imaginary discretion, and they decided that it was not, that Jessica was being hysterical, and I, as you mentioned in the documentary, at one point called her ridiculous, et cetera. And so the civil rights claim was based on the fact that these police officers chose to use discretion that they should not have had, right? It should have been mandatory that they made this arrest, and they refused to do that. Do you want me to explain the Supreme Court?
Sure, yeah, because that was then the next logical step. When you realized you couldn't take the case any further in that regard, then you moved on to the Supreme Court, correct? And how did that happen?
Actually, it was Castle Rock that was the plaintiff in that. I was the defendant.
Okay.
No, I really was the defendant in that one. It wasn't my fault. That one wasn't.
That's okay.
I'm responsible for all the other.
Are we talking about at the Supreme Court level?
At the Supreme Court.
Appellant. Not defendant, appellant.
Oh, okay, your turn.
It's okay. No.
You're up.
Well, how did it get to the Supreme Court then? Since that's really what I think was what put this case on the map.
Right.
And why? And why did it? Why? How did it reach the Supreme Court?
So as I mentioned, at the district court level, Jessica's case was dismissed. We won't go into the motions, but it was dismissed at the district court level.
Right.
Jessica and her attorneys appealed that decision, and eventually through the appeals process, the decision made it to the 10th Circuit. There was a 10th Circuit hearing and then an en banc hearing. Legally is not important, but the 10th Circuit heard this case, which is the appellate court, and it's the highest court that you can get to before going to the Supreme Court. Obviously, the Supreme Court doesn't hear all cases that get appealed from the circuit level. The Supreme Court gets to choose the cases that it hears each term. So it was not guaranteed that Jessica's case would end up being heard by the Supreme Court, but they chose to hear the case after the 10th Circuit decision. The 10th Circuit decision was actually in Jessica's favor. Jessica won the case at the 10th Circuit at the appellate level. And then the Supreme Court, in an opinion by the now deceased Justice Scalia, decided to overturn the 10th Circuit decision. And basically their rationale was that, and it's a complicated and totally like unreadable case, so just know that. Don't try to read it. It's incredibly circuitous. But the Supreme Court basically said that Jessica had no right to have the restraining order enforced, that the Colorado statute and the language on the restraining order was not actually mandatory, didn't make any sort of enforcement mandatory. There was no positive right that she had.
The word shall didn't mean must.
Right. The word shall, which should mean must, did not mean must in this case somehow. And so according to this Supreme Court decision, the restraining order was essentially not worth the paper that it was printed on. That's the sort of takeaway, the end result.
And so for you, Jessica, that must have been heartbreaking to have gone. Can you walk us through that and how you got through it?
Absolutely. You know, that was devastating to think that women and children and men alike were no longer going to be protected under any type of law, unless it was something that your state and county was going to continue to do because it was something, a working mechanism that they could count on. And that's really the only way these orders are still in motion, is by the grace of your own county or state that's honoring them.
So,
but
most
for me, it was devastating. For 2 years, I crashed. But my whole thing was, this is not acceptable, and there's got to be something more than the Supreme Court. And that's how we found the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Everybody's got a boss, right?
That's
what
the
I
Supreme
said.
Court's boss.
That's what
saying?
I said. Everybody's got a boss.
So what is this body? And I mean, I think that's what's really remarkable about your story too, is most people would go up against the Supreme Court and to receive news like that would just quit and go home. But you researched another way to try to get your story out. But can you explain what this body is and why you kept going and what? What does it matter that they would hear your case?
I think I'm going to let Nicole explain the commissioners, and then I can talk about my experience.
Sure. Yeah. So there's an organization, the Organization of American States, and that sort of international organization, part of that international organization is the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And basically, it is an international body, and it's sort of like an international court that can provide relief, right, in human rights, in cases of human rights violations. So that's sort of what the body is. Decisions from international courts are problematic in that in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases, they're not. It's not mandatory that a country like the United States abide by them necessarily.
So, were you hoping to shame or get the Department of Justice to hear this case, or someone else to just pay attention to it because of the domestic violence component? Or what was the thought process behind doing that?
Well, my whole thing was shaming the United States because we are the third world country where it comes to human rights. So my country should be ashamed of how they treat their citizens. And I guess I'm here to out them. And it wasn't, there's no other way to say it, but awareness has been my success. Not because my government has given me any free passes, but the awareness of this case has been the success of it.
So in the film, we see you go up and testify in front of the tribunal two times, correctly? The first time, what happened? It didn't go through, or it did go through, because then you went back again, and that's where you said, I can't hear you deny me again.
That probably had been like the third or fourth time we had gone in, and I finally walked out because you can only hear the Justice Department say so many times, we're not going to represent you, we've got nothing to help you, and we're not going to take the decision and implement it, we're not going to go back to Colorado and strip down their police departments and rebuild them to a place of actual functioning and working police departments, because they're simply not.
And so where does that leave you now? Where does the case stand now?
Still where it always has. It's up in the air. My life is not complete because I don't know my answers, but I don't know that I ever will. And that's something I just have to accept. But I'll probably do this till my dying day and try to always make better strides for this world. Yeah. even if I don't get my answers.
And I'm sure in this work, for both of you, you've come across women who are families who have been in similar situations, or even, you know, people who get restraining orders. And so what advice do you have for them? What do you tell them about situations like these, or how can people protect themselves?
You know, it's really basic rules of thumb. It's recognizing, number one, that you're in danger. Number two, always having a safety plan and knowing that you have to have your documents, your identification, birth certificates, extra money, change of clothes. I mean, it really does get that desperate for some people to leave. And when they get the opportunity, they should. At the time that a restraining order is being given, you know, to the abuser, that family, that victim and her children need to be able to go someplace for a couple of weeks, because that's the height of danger. That's when you're taking all of their power and their that dominant behavior, and you're reclaiming it, and you're going to toss that cart over and over and over. So in order to keep yourself safe, it's best to remove yourself from your normal situation for a while.
Right. So I want to be sure and have enough time to answer any questions from the audience. So I'm going to open it up to questions for the audience. If you have a question for either Nicole or Jessica, if you could just come down and talk into the microphone, that would be great. And in the meantime, Nicole, if you could talk about what are things that you and Carrie Bettinger-Lopez and Jessica are working on now in this arena, or moving forward to try to change things?
Yeah. So I don't want to paint such a bleak picture about the OAS and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, right? Obviously it's not, you know, it's not sort of the automatic fix that we would like.
But they're superior.
But yeah, well, so the object in part is shame, right? International bodies that sort of that deal with enforcing international human rights, part of that is bringing the attention of the international community to the problematic behavior of a government.
Or what about local or state activism?
Right.
What about, you know, I know international is an important part of your campaign, but what about activating local
yes.
or state representatives?
So the kind of implementation of the decision from the Inter-American Commission ultimately falls to local and state governments and local activists, right? So thus far, the decision has been implemented in a couple of different ways. The first and sort of most major, and I'll get to state and local, but I'm going to start with federal first, is that in 2015, the DOJ issued guidance on eliminating gender discrimination in policing. Oh, great, thank you. So that was a huge win. And then sort of following from that DOJ guidance, there have been state and local police forces and departments that have applied for grants, gotten funding, changed training programs, et cetera. And one of Carrie's major projects, and one project which I did a little bit of work on while I was working for her, was her Courage in Policing project. Courage stands for community-oriented and united responses to gender-based violence and equality. It's sort of a long acronym, but basically it is a program that takes an adapted survey from the National Domestic Violence Hotline and applies it to a particular city. In this case, we're starting with Miami because that's where Professor Bettinger-Lopez is the head of the Human Rights Clinic at Miami Law, and where I worked for her when I was in law school. And so they essentially use this survey to evaluate responses to law enforcement locally, and then with the information from that survey, they can inform police okay. training programs and do the best that you possibly can to sort of eliminate that gender bias, right? And quite frankly, I think that that's the local enforcement piece is one of the most important ones, because that police discretion is always going to be there. You're never going to eliminate all of it, right? It's built into the way that policing works, community policing works. And I'm not even suggesting that it should necessarily be completely eliminated, right? There does have to be some discretion. The issue is getting to individual officers such that they're trained to deal with situations like this, and they do not react in accordance with these gender biases and stereotypes. So that's what this program aims to address.
My question is, in a sense, like states' rights against federal rights, if the state of Colorado actually had a statute that that was mandatory arrest in the case of a protective order, how can the federal government then turn around and say, that's basically worthless? Right. I mean, why was that, or how many states have those?
We don't get it either.
Mandatory, you know, have those kinds of statutes. Right. And I would think that there would be an uproar just on that level of the states versus the federal, because clearly the state wanted that to be the case.
Of course, right. That is why they took it there. But you're not the only one asking that question. I've been asking it for years. It's part of my frustration. It's just like, ooh, how could this be overlooked in something so obvious? And the fact that the word shall was in place at the time, and it was their obligation, but it's not mandatory for them to know their job. So shall meant nothing because they didn't recognize it. They didn't have to.
And the states can have laws and statutes, and they mean nothing.
So the decision is an interesting read.
Did it make sense to you as a lawyer at all?
Yeah. No. Yeah.
it's a lot of. So this is. I will say that this is part of why the there's this emphasis on gender bias, right? Because I think we forget that, look, the nine justices, right, are people. They are operating with their own biases, their own stereotypes, their own worldview.
All except for Clarence Thomas.
Not go there. Right,
he slept through my whole thing. I can go there.
Oh, no, you can. You can. I'm just...
Okay.
It's really only eight justices.
So I think it is the whole decision discusses property right. Right. It is a complex decision that I won't go into super.
Yeah. Let's
into
go
detail,
to the next question.
I know it's horrible. I mean,
but
think of my children as property.
Your point is totally valid. There are many lawyers that read this decision and thought this is absolute. You know, nonsense. And you know, there was a dissenting decision, right? The Justice Stevens and Justice Ginsburg wrote a very powerful dissent in which they found a property right in the restraining order and said, based on the Colorado statute, this is what the wording says, right? So it's a sort of a, from the Supreme Court perspective, reasonable minds can disagree, but. Again, you have a Supreme Court that at the time that was overwhelmingly male, and so in my view, I think you know personally.
And Rehnquist just showed up just to like thwart me because he left four times. I missed a prostate cancer himself, and he had to show up for my case. It was terrible. It was terrible.
Yeah. Thank you on behalf of all of us women for. Standing up for all women and families. Speaking of bias, you mentioned earlier that maybe your ethnicity had a part in it, their last name. Would you comment on that?
Absolutely. I think just statistically, women of color are not heard most of the time. Just the last name. If I were an Anglo-Saxon woman, or this is how I put it at Congress, I said, women of no color, need to learn to respect women that have color? And should we get the Equal Rights Amendment written into the Constitution, which is something I'm working on and very passionate about? Now we have to teach each other how to behave and treat each other fairly. So that's just my pet little project right now.
So I'm a retired attorney, and in the 80s I handled some cases like this, representing women, and I would say to them, I can get your restraining order. It's a piece of paper, but do you have a father, brother, uncle, cousin who can put this guy up against the wall and use language he understands?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would have loved that advice. Like, I would have found somebody lickety-split.
You wish that someone had given you that advice?
Yeah. But because we don't follow that because it's against the law, we don't recommend those things.
I didn't recommend anything. I just said, do you have somebody who could do this?
Right.
Most of these were intelligent women.
Hoarding is everything.
I never found out what they did, but I never had one of my people get beaten up after that.
Fabulous.
So, and I haven't practiced law for more than 5 years, and this, I only did that law in the 80s, so maybe you would know now whether that would still be an appropriate question to
ask your
client.
I think it would be appropriate action altogether, just because something needs to take place other than nothing. And I love your whole, like, smear. I would love it.
So I appreciate your opinion. I'd like to hear from the attorney, but I'm not sure that I want to. I understand.
I won't answer that
yeah.
question, but I appreciate the look, creative lawyering comes
that's,
in many
that's total
forms.
Goddess. I love that.
But I do think it speaks to having a support system, having a plan, having people that you can rely on. You need that. So, I mean, that's definitely one way you could go, but I think you need to have a strong support system around you. Go ahead.
I think, were you up next this week? Oh, thank you. I don't know. I never talk into microphones. I don't know how loud this is.
You're
so
good. Perfect.
I just turned 20, and the last few years, it's really become clear to me how dark the world can be. I have seen so many friends, and myself included, go through sexual assaults and just violence itself. And honestly, I don't have a question. I just felt inclined to come up and say that I think the world is really lucky to have women like you. And sometimes I could tell in the documentary, you know, it's so hard. Sometimes when you feel like you're fighting a fight that seems so pointless at times. And I just want you to know that you are inspiring a lot of people and causing a lot of change. And I think you're affecting a lot of people, like a lot more than you really think. And I obviously haven't felt what you felt, but I felt the frustration, I think, you know, little bits of it that you felt. And I'm so glad that the world has people like you, and I didn't know if I'd really have a minute to say that to you personally or not, so I just wanted to come up and say it, and thank you.
Thank you for being so brave.
Do you think things have gotten better for women since this happened to you?
Absolutely, but only because we claim it, because we've had our eyes wide open, waiting for this opportunity, and it came. And we didn't let it pass. And that's really, really imperative that we recognize that we've already made that first move as women, because we stick together. As hard as it is, we do stick together through all our different points of view and upbringing and, you know, just our backgrounds. We all still stand together, and that's really an incredible thing to me. I just know that this is the time. This is our time.
And I know that you're not from Colorado, but is destroying evidence not a crime in itself in Colorado?
Yes, it's actually a crime in any state. Forensics should never be destroyed until the case is solved.
And so did they suffer any repercussions from this?
Oh, no. No, no. As a matter of fact, the Justice Department, I would like to get them involved, but not during this administration. And I think now we're looking at it where it is time to strip the Castle Rock and the Denver Police Departments down and help rebuild them. Not just strip them down, but help rebuild them.
And then I did have a second question on the word shall. So is that just a floating word where sometimes it means and sometimes it doesn't?
Well, it's no longer part of the Colorado language. It's no longer what it's meant, what it was meant to be, which was to give no discernment to the officers. I mean, honestly, we're not asking them to be rocket scientists. It's really not their job to discern this or that or the other thing. Just do your job. Know your job enough to say, this is critical. We need to move on this and, you know, figure it out. But they just have never been trained to make that discernment. So must doesn't mean must to them. Shall. They didn't even know the word existed, I don't think, in their language.
I'm gonna make one comment on that, and that's just I focus on the wording, particularly in light of the fact that the majority opinion was written by Justice Scalia, who was a textualist, right, and an originalist. And so from Scalia's perspective, traditionally in his decisions, you know, you could at least count on his use, you know, I say nothing else, but at least count on his use of, like, dictionary definitions of words, right? And or dictionary definitions informed by history. And in this particular decision, it seems like that was quite easily abandoned. And so that's why I made that's why I focus on the sort of shall equals must distinction. I mean, it should be the same thing. It's sort of a common statutory, right? We don't use that word anymore, right? It means will, right? But in statutory language, typically it's the word shall is used to mean must, right? And when you do deal with sort of statutory interpretation, as the justices do, right? Like they typically decide on kind of universal definitions for certain words. And for Scalia, shall was must. For nearly every other jurist, that's what it means. And so that was the focus of my, you know, my comment.
Okay. Sorry. One last question here, and then I have one last question for Jessica.
To your knowledge, are there any other cases that focus on this issue that are working their way up through the district and circuit and appellate court?
That's a great question. I'm sure that there are, and there were sort of similar cases prior, but I would have to do some research before answering your question more specifically.
I've never really thought about that. I mean, never researched that myself.
So, Jessica, last question for you. Can you tell us what it is that you're doing now? Do you still live in Colorado? What are you doing now, and what are your days like now?
Oh, my goodness. I got to go to Cornell in March. And ironically enough, there was a feminist fellowship, the Dorothy S. Clark Feminist Fellowship opened up, and I found it a perfect fit for me. So I'm at Cornell Law School now, and my first week there. So that's what I'm doing, is taking a semester to retreat at Cornell and learn a little bit while I'm there and teach a little bit while I'm there. Pretty exciting stuff.
Last question. You're still in contact with your son, and things are good there?
Oh, my son. He's 32. He's in the Air Force, and I've got 3 grandchildren. So, yeah, God is not unkind. He leaves us with something, you know. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Nicole.
Thank you for having us.